a regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. You know, we are getting into the summer season. We've got a lot of events going on around the country. We were talking yesterday with Toby Leary from Cape Gunworks about the Gold 250 event, which is coming up in just a matter of weeks here, June 13th in Boxborough, Massachusetts. There are a couple of other events that are coming up as well that I've been invited to take part in, but I'm not going to be able to make it, unfortunately. So we're going to be talking with the organizers of those events. You've got a great firearms conference that is coming up also in Massachusetts, a regional event that's going to be, I think, featuring some fantastic guests. Holly Sullivan, who is one of my co-board members of the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep Bear Arms, has been spearheading this. We're going to talk with Holly in just a matter of days. I'm going to be sending a video to that conference, but I won't be able to make it in person. And another event that is coming up is June 20th. It's the Boot Camp for Patriots in, I apologize if I pronounce this incorrectly, Ronkonkoma, New York, which is, I believe, out on Long Island. And it's being put together by the Association of Mature American Citizens. Sounds like it's going to be a fantastic event. I wish that I could be there, but unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to make it. But they've got, last year, I think they had over 500 people in attendance. This year, the White House Freedom Truck is going to be on site for the weekend. So, great way to celebrate, again, this nation's 250th birthday. And we're going to talk for a couple minutes with Dave Weber, the owner and president of AMAC, about this Boot Camp for Patriots, what folks can expect, including the Second Amendment component of the weekend. We're also on today's program going to be talking about this article from The Trace. I laughed out loud when I read this. A top analyst explains why America's second great crime decline could already be here and why this trend is so difficult to explain. Now, they're talking with a guy named Jeff Asher, who I actually respect quite a bit, and I have cited Jeff Asher's real-time crime dashboard at Bearing Arms on a number of occasions. What made me laugh about this is that The Trace can't figure out why crime is plummeting at a time of increased availability of firearms, because they are so insistent that more guns must equal more crime. And yet, this is being disproven on a daily basis. So we're going to get into that as well in just a couple of minutes. But right now, let's kick off our conversation with Dave Weber from AMAC. Take a look and a listen. Dave, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you this morning.
Pleasure to have for me to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm grateful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to talk about the Boot Camp for Patriots. I'm grateful for the invitation to come speak, and I'm sorry that I'm not going to be able to attend. But for folks who don't know, what is AMAC?
So that's a great question. AMAC, I always look at AMAC as a home for conservative, freedom-loving Americans. And really, there's at our core, we are a member-focused, member-driven organization. When you join AMAC, you're supporting an organization that truly loves the United States of America. Well, I believe this is the greatest country that has ever existed. And so, you know, you're supporting an organization that fundamentally believes in the values of freedom, faith, and individual liberty. There really are three parts to AMAC. First is the membership component. And when you join AMAC, you gain access to a host of member benefits, from discounts on travel and hotels, car rentals, insurance products, roadside assistance plans. We have a team of dedicated Medicare advisors that can help with all things Medicare. Those are some of the benefits you get. You also get, I brought a couple of copies of our AMAC magazine. You also get the AMAC magazine delivered to your mailbox every other month. And our members really love the magazine. It's full of hard-hitting information from our newsline team. We also publish content daily on our website, and our newsline team of writers is growing every day. So we're excited about that.
I was going to say, before we get any further, we should probably mention what AMAC stands for, right? The yes. Association of Mature American Citizens. So this is sort of the, would you describe it as like a conservative counter to AARP?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our members affectionately refer to us as the conservatives' alternative to AARP.
Okay.
Long ago, my father was AMAC's founder, and he was a longtime AARP member. And over time, he grew increasingly frustrated at their stance on issues. He felt like they no longer represented him. Now, my father was a man of great faith, and when they would publish an article about faith, he was expecting, you know, not for it to be about burning incense and that kind of stuff. So he sought for an alternative and really was unable to find one. And being a believer in free enterprise, said, well, I'm sure there are people out there who feel exactly like I do, so I'm going to build an alternative. And that's what we did in 2007. Him, my mother, my sister, and I sat around a coffee table and kicked around this idea. And after coming up on 2 decades now, it's been a long road, but we have firmly established ourselves. We have over 2 million members and we're growing. And we have teams of people that are doing really good things for all Americans. Liberal Americans don't realize we're helping them too, but I think in the long run, they'll see the fruits of our labor too.
So you've got the member component, and then you've got, what are the other components of this organization?
So two other components. We have the AMAC Foundation. The AMAC Foundation is primarily responsible for promoting our educational programs and resources. That includes our signature Social Security advisory services. We have a team of nationally accredited Social Security advisors who are able to help and counsel people through the complex Social Security questions that they face. For example, when should they collect? What happens with their spousal benefits if their spouse should pass away? There's so many questions that wanting to ensure that people have Social Security when they retire, that everything they've paid in to it, their entire working career is there for them, but also to be able to counsel them through these complex questions. And we've been able to help thousands of people at absolutely no cost. It's a free service through the foundation. So we're excited about that, and that continues to grow. And then the last part of AMAC is AMAC Action. That is the team that gets things done on Capitol Hill. We are on the front lines working with our members and for our members on really critical issues that America's facing: election integrity, securing our borders, protecting our children in schools, and defending parental rights. We're protecting life at all stages from conception through natural death. And of course, important to me is restoring our fundamental right to keep and bear arms.
Well, that is also important to me too. So I'm glad we're on the same page there. And there is going to be a Second Amendment component to this Boot Camp for Patriots that's coming up on June the 20th, the weekend of June the 20th, right?
Yes, that's correct. And we're excited about that. We've not had a Second Amendment panel before, but we are putting together a panel of people. The details are to be determined. We're still interviewing speakers and potential panel guests. But we really want to talk about maybe some of the historical importance of the Second Amendment, why the founders enshrined that right into our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, what it really means. It's amazing when you consider that our founders, it took them 27 words to manage all gun regulation in America, 27 words in our Second Amendment. And half of those words are really a prologue to the meat of it, which is that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. That's it. And today, fast forward, we have 20 some odd thousand laws nationwide. And I think that inch by inch, we've incrementally given away our right to keep and bear arms to the point we don't recognize it today. And so that's why I'm so focused with AMAC moving forward to help restore that right to where it should be. And the Trump administration and our rock star, Harmeet Dhillon, is just doing phenomenal things even in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I actually had the opportunity to speak with the Assistant Attorney General on Monday of this week to talk about the new lawsuits and get caught up on some of the ones that have already been filed. And yeah, and I know that, look, we live in a day and age where, everybody's a critic. And there are some folks who say, well, the DOJ is not doing enough. I mean, I'd love to see DOJ stopped defending things like the National Firearms Act. But Harvey Dillon has explained, you know, there is a strategy involved and there is a duty, frankly, to the DOJ to defend some of these laws. But the DOJ has been very active, I think, in, you know, trying to roll back, for instance, the prohibition on mailing handguns through the Postal Service. You can already mail long guns. They want to revise that rule. So, yeah, they're doing incredible work. And, you know, putting cities like Denver on notice, states like Virginia, where I live, on notice that, hey, you know, these bans on commonly owned firearms, we're going to challenge them in court. I think is hugely important. And I'm, you know, I imagine, I know that the Boot Camp for Patriots is going to be taking place in New York. And I imagine that New York may be facing a lawsuit regarding their gun control laws from the DOJ. They certainly face a number of lawsuits from Second Amendment organizations already.
I certainly hope so. You know, I got to tell you, living in New York, it feels like we're behind enemy lines with regards to the Second Amendment. When I filed for my pistol permit, it took 22 months before I actually had a permit in my hand. I had to go through background checks. I had to do in-person interviews at my local police precinct. I had to have my fingerprints taken, mugshots taken. I had to provide proof of residence, background information. I had to provide a voting registration card. I had to provide prescription drug history for 10 years. I mean, that's what I deal with in New York. So you can understand why I'm a little frustrated with the speed at which we're trying to restore these Second Amendment rights. But I follow someone named Mark Smith. He's a constitutional attorney, a member of the Supreme Court bar, and he's got a YouTube channel. And, and so I learn a lot from him. It's a little bit on the, you know, the legal technical side, but I appreciate that because I'm educating myself. And he always says it's brick by brick. So case by case, we have brick by brick where we're restoring, rebuilding our right to keep and bear arms. And I do believe that when you look at, especially over the last 15 years or so, it's going back to 2008, the Supreme Court in their Heller decision, which said that arms that are in common use for lawful purposes cannot be banned. And then you move forward through all the way through 2022. Here, right here in New York, was the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen, which declared New York's licensing scheme, which I had to go through, declared that unconstitutional and replaced it with a supposedly simpler process. Although our Governor Hochul, within 2 weeks, had already passed legislation to find ways around it. So it's a never-ending battle. I'm frustrated that Supreme Court doesn't act more quickly. We've got probably a dozen cases scheduled for conference that they've, you know, been kicking the can down the road. Yeah. We're waiting for that for a long time. There's one case, Duncan v. Bonta, which challenges California's quote-unquote high-capacity magazine ban, which is really just a standard magazine ban, magazine device for your firearm. That case has got to be 10 years old now. So, you know, we're frustrated with the process. But we do know that it's brick by brick.
That was one of those cases that was up before the Supreme Court when Bruen was handed down, and it got GVR'd.
Yes.
And now it's back up again. I got to tell you, Dave, for somebody who, you know, is not with a Second Amendment specific organization, I'm very impressed with your knowledge of Second Amendment issues. There are a lot of folks who, you know, who I talk to who definitely support the right to keep your arms, but they're not necessarily on top of these things. So I appreciate your diligence. And this, again, is something that that you want AMAC to be involved in. You want to be a welcoming space for gun owners, Second Amendment supporters, and you want the organization, it sounds like, to play a role in defending our Second Amendment rights.
That's right. We're going to be doing more of that. I think it's so critical. I think it's the one part of our Constitution that gives teeth to the entire document. It's truly remarkable when you understand and you research and understand why our founders were adamant that the people had the right to keep and bear arms, that the people would be armed. If you remember the shot heard around the world, the opening shots at the revolution were at Concord and Lexington, and they were fired because the British had sent troops to seize colonial arms and disarm the Americans. And that's so that right there was a line in the sand. And our founders, in their infinite wisdom, enshrined that into our Constitution so that it could never be taken from us. Although, you know, you question if that's the reality today.
Right. Well, as you say, we are clawing back some rights, but, you know, I'm working on a piece actually for Bearing Arms later today Going back to 1981, and there was a document that was put together by a it was the National Coalition to Ban Handguns. It was their statement on the Second Amendment. And right up front, you do not have a constitutional right to own a handgun, they said. And, you know, their position was that you didn't have a right to own a, you know, a bolt action rifle either, or a double action shotgun. Right. You had the right to own nothing when it came to the right to keep arms, because it was a collective right to perhaps serve in a militia, that that right had been, you know, basically nullified by the existence of the National Guard. So you talk about, you know, clawing our rights back. We have, we definitely are doing that, but we also have come a long way, I think, in, you know, the last 40 or 50 years, the Heller decision. It's amazing to me that we've got people who, you know, are old enough to buy a firearm now who are not old enough to remember the Heller decision coming down, right? They have grown up in a world in which it's just accepted that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms. And, you know, that was not the case. We may be able to read the plain text of the Second Amendment, but for decades we were told, no, it doesn't mean what you think it means. It's not about you and I being able to own a firearm, right? It's about, again, being able to serve in a militia. So we have made, I think, substantial progress, and I think we're going to continue to make substantial progress. But a lot of that, again, is through, you know, the grassroots efforts of gun owners supporting organizations that are challenging these laws. And, you know, it sounds again like this boot camp for patriots that you guys have coming up the weekend of June the 20th is going to be a way for attendees to learn how to become more effective activists. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. That's fair to say. And also to be a part of the process. You know, people are intimidated. They don't know how to get involved in politics. And we make that easy. We provide a path. First of all, just join us. We can help you. And to whatever level you want to get involved, if you just want to support us and we'll do the work, that's fine. If you want to actually become an AMAC delegate, we have hundreds of delegates across the country now. And you can organize locally. And so there's a role for you from just joining all the way to helping us into actually being on Capitol Hill with us. We just did a delegate fly-in about 2 weeks ago in D.C., where our delegates actually meet us in Washington, and we go door-to-door and push forth. So we, like I said, we create a path for people to get involved. And many people just unfortunately don't know how to get involved. And we believe, you know, politics is obviously on the national stage, but it's so important for people to get involved in their local elections, in their on their school boards, and we can help with all that stuff. So when you join AMAC, you have a team of resources, people that believe in the same things as you and want to help you and will help you.
So if folks want more information about AMAC itself or the Boot Camp for Patriots, where do they get more info, Dave?
So you can visit us online at amac.us. That's amac.us. You'll find information on our boot camp coming up in June. We also have our America's 250th anniversary celebratory cruise, which will be in Alaska in August. We have regular events and delegate conferences. We have weekly webinars covering a variety of topics from protecting yourself against scams to, you know, how to navigate the Medicare maze. So we've got a lot of resources. And it's at amac.us. We encourage you to visit the site, learn about our boot camp, and join AMAC.
Well, Dave, again, I appreciate your time. I am sorry that I'm not going to be able to be in attendance at the Boot Camp for Patriots this year, but hopefully next year I'll get another invite and I'll be able to make it. You guys will have another Second Amendment panel, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about who you do get to speak about the right to keep your arms, and would love to have you back maybe for an after action report when the boot camp wraps up.
That'd be great. And the invitation is a standing offer. We'd love to see you next year.
I appreciate that, Dave. Thank you so much for your time today and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you again.
And thanks again to Dave Weber for joining us on the program. And again, I was really impressed by his knowledge of the Second Amendment. I think the fact that he's a gun owner, had to go through this process himself in New York State. you know, if you care about your Second Amendment rights at all, having to deal with New York's gun laws, boy, that's going to make you a Second Amendment advocate, I would think. Anyway, I look forward to talking with Dave again in the future, and really do thank him for his time. Now, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, as I mentioned, I want to talk about this a piece of the trace real quick. Tom Knighton, my colleague at Bearing Arms, has written a post about this, but I generally like Jeff Asher, the criminologist that the Trace's Chip Brownlee spoke to about the second great crime decline and why it could already be here. I was a little disappointed to see Jeff Asher talking to the Trace, but you know what? I'm actually going to reach out to him myself and see if he'll do equal time. Since I talked to the gun control crowd, maybe he'll talk to the Second Amendment crowd as well. And, you know, when it comes to explaining why we've seen this, not just significant, but this historic decline in violent crime and in homicides, I really appreciate the fact that Jeff Asher says, I don't know why it's happening. Because so many people will offer their theories, it's because of this one thing. I don't think it is because of one thing. I think we're looking at a variety of factors. But it is worth noting, and I was actually kind of surprised to see the Trace had this graphic. The national homicide rate in historical context, they say. And they've got a graph going back to 1900, where the homicide rate was 6.4 per 100,000 people. And it climbs. There are a couple of years where it dips a little bit, but generally speaking, it climbs from about 1900 to about 1933, when the homicide rate was 9.7 per 100,000 people. And then you saw really the first great crime decline. They call what's happening right now the second, but this is actually probably the third. The first great crime decline happened in the 1930s. Homicide rate in 1933, as I mentioned, peaked at 9.7 per 100,000 people. It continued falling until basically the end of World War II. In 1944, the homicide rate was 4.9 per 100,000 people. 1945, ticks up to 5.6. 1946, ticks up to 6.3. But then it drops down again until 1963. Homicide rate was 4.6 per 100,000 people. And then it starts going up, 4.9 in 64, 5.1 in 65. We have the Gun Control Act of 1968. Right? Homicide rate 6.9 per 100,000 people when the Gun Control Act is passed. Does nothing to reduce violent crime. Instead, by 1974, homicides at 9.8 per 100,000, higher than they were at that point, the highest rate in the 20th century. Had a little bit of a tick down in the mid 70s, but by 1980, homicides 10.2 per 100,000 people. Again, a new high, right? The homicide rates dipped throughout the first part of the 1980s, climbed back up again in the early 1990s. We once again reach a homicide rate of 9.8. 1993, it's 9.5. And then it really starts to go down. And it drops down to 2014. Homicide rate was 4.4 per 100,000 people. That was the lowest recorded at the time in the, in more than 100 years, right? There's a little bit of a tick up, 2015. Then you get to COVID. You get the, you know, closing of the jails, the closing of the court system, the civil unrest and the riots that we saw. And homicides jump up from 5.1 per 100,000 people in 2019 to 6.7 in 2020. And basically stay there, 6.5 in 2021, 6.6 in 2022. And then it really starts to drop again. Even in 2023, it was 5.9 per 100,000 people, so not a significant drop. 2004, it drops down to 5 per 100,000 people. 2005, it's estimated that the homicide rate was 4 per 100,000 people. Again, the lowest in 125 years, at least. And this happens, again, just a few years after we saw the great gun run of 2020 and 2021. This happens at a time in which we still have more than a million gun sales per month. And not all of those are new firearms. But still, a significant number of firearms entering the hands of American citizens, right? And so, again, for the Trace and for gun control advocates, this should be an impossibility. The fundamental premise of the gun control movement is that more guns equals more crime. This is why Dr. John Lott's book, More Guns, Less Crime, was a direct refutation of that. And again, we've known this because from, again, 1993 to 2014, you saw violent crime and homicides drop dramatically. But we didn't see fewer guns during that time period, right? That actually coincides with the expansion of the right to carry. States going from may issue to shall issue. More people bearing arms in public did not lead to more crime. And even over the last, 5 to 6 years, you could talk about a similar phenomenon happening with constitutional carry. So now more than half the country doesn't require a permit to carry. If you can lawfully possess that firearm, generally speaking, you can lawfully carry it. This should make crime explode if you're a believer in gun control. And yet, again, what we are seeing here is the biggest drop in our homicide rate in recorded U.S. history. And a homicide rate that is about half, actually less than half, of what it was at its peak in the 1930s, again in the early 1970s, and again in the early 1990s. At a time in which we have, 400,000 plus firearms, about 100 million gun owners. So Chip Brownlee of The Trace asks Jeff Asher, why did this happen and why is it still happening? And Asher says, I don't know, and stop asking me. I think it was a bit of a joke. He said, it's such a difficult question. It's the question of our time. He said, one of the frustrating things about following the what so closely is that there isn't more attention being paid to the why. He says, the only explanations that are ever offered feel like they're for political purposes rather than treating this as a national research-based emergency to figure out exactly why this is happening so we can continue it. He said, instead, from a leadership perspective, I think political leaders on both sides of the aisle tend to say it's because of X rather than saying we don't really know and it behooves us to understand it better. But he notes again that this is happening at a time, he says, the impact of federal spending might play a role. He says the expansion of programs and interventions, including things like ceasefire and violence interrupters. He says there are five main points you have to account for. One, this is happening everywhere, so it's probably not local factors. And it's not happening everywhere. But it is happening, I think, in a majority of American cities. Two, he says it happened at a time of decreased police presence. We have fewer officers everywhere. That much is true. Three, he says it happened at a time in which we haven't solved the root causes of crime. It's not like we fixed poverty and education. These are still obviously major issues. And he's right. Fourth, he says the country is still awash in guns. Gun sales are still at elevated levels, even though they've come down a little bit. And he says, five, there haven't been any major breakthroughs in police efficiency. He says clearance rates plunged in 2020. So now they're rising again. That probably has more to do with the fact that murder is falling than anything else. And he says, so you've got to account for all of those factors. And he says, there's not a lot that answers that. He says, I think the idea that John Roman has talked about makes a lot of sense. So he says, we threw a lot of money at a lot of things. Some of it undoubtedly worked. We don't necessarily know which things worked, but every city tried different things, and every city generally had success because they were able to try things. But we don't know which of those things were the most important and impactful or what we should do the next time. Now, I will note that Jeff Asher just said a few paragraphs earlier, it's probably not local factors. And then he suggests that, well, it's probably local factors. So as much as I like Jeff Asher, as much as I appreciate the work that he does, there's an inconsistency there. But I would also note, and I think Costas Morris from the Second Amendment Foundation pointed this out on X yesterday, you know, at some point you do have to start asking, do these pro-gun policies have a deterrent effect? Right? When I write about, for instance, when I was writing about the decline in homicides in Baltimore, which happened to coincide with the Bruin decision and the end of Maryland's May issue carrying regime, I would write, I'm not saying that crime is falling because Maryland went from may issue to shall issue, but I am saying that crime is falling while there are more people legally carrying firearms. Costas suggested, well, maybe we do have to say that one of the reasons why crime is falling is because more people are carrying. And I think that there is something to that. Jeff Asher acknowledged that, yes, you know, this is crime is dropping at a time in which there is a country still awash in guns, right? Gun sales still at elevated levels. And certainly gun ownership is higher than it was. And again, Jeff Asher doesn't even talk about the progress that's been made in terms of the right to carry, the demise of may-issue carry laws, the rise of constitutional carry in more than half the country. So, I agree. There isn't one single answer. I think programs like Ceasefire have been effective because we know, again, that violent crime, a very small portion of a city's community, maybe 1% of a city's population responsible for as much as 63% of violent crime, according to one study. So when you have these targeted deterrence programs, right, the programs that look at that 1% and say, okay, we're gonna get tough on these people. We're not going to offer them plea bargains, but also we're going to offer them an opportunity to turn their life around. When you look at targeted deterrence programs that focus on the geographic areas, these small portions of cities that have these very high crime rates, and it could be a particular corner, and we're going to flood that area with law enforcement officers. I think those things do have an impact, and they do make a difference. But I also believe that the number of Americans who are exercising the right to keep and bear arms, particularly the right to bear arms, is having an impact as well. Because when you look at what's happened in cities that are in states where constitutional carry is in place, Miami, Florida, for instance, had the fewest number of homicides. This was 2024. They had the fewest number of homicides since 1947. That's the first full year in which constitutional carry was in effect in Florida. And the numbers went down even further last year. So arguably, you've got more people carrying, right? Certainly easier for people to carry because they don't need to get the carry license in Florida anymore. Again, if you're a gun control activist, your assumption would be, okay, well, crime's going to soar. Because now you've got all these people that are walking around toting guns. They get angry with each other. They whip out their gun. They start shooting. And instead, we've seen the opposite of that. I suspect that there are more people carrying firearms in Miami than there were 5 years ago. So why are there fewer homicides? Again, probably a variety of reasons. But I think one of those reasons is that criminals are a little more concerned that they may encounter an armed citizen rather than an unarmed victim if they decide to carjack somebody, if they decide to commit a random home invasion. And I think they maybe are a little bit more precautious about their activities and certainly their targets than they would have been just a few years ago. Anyway, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I did find it fascinating that the Trace is acknowledging that this is happening, because it really is. It's an existential crisis for the gun control lobby. At a time in which they predicted violent crime would soar, homicides and violent crime are at record lows. And that's bad news for the gun control lobby. It just is. It's good news for the rest of us, though. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen Story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with shooting in Boston on Monday. Retired judge, this is from CBS in Boston, retired judge defends 2021 sentence of an accused Memorial Drive gunman. Not a failure of the justice system. Want to bet? Judge Jack Liu, who was the chair of the Massachusetts Sentencing Commission, spoke to CBS News in Boston. And he said, the judge doesn't have a crystal ball. The judge doesn't have extrasensory perception. The judge doesn't have ESP. The judge has to do what's fair for everybody. No, the judge doesn't. The judge has to ensure that justice is done. And arguably, by taking what the prosecutor had recommended, 10 to 12 years in prison, cutting it in half, 5 to 6 years in prison, the judge did not do what was fair for everybody. As the prosecutor at the time actually pointed out, this guy, Tyler Brown, was not only sentenced to 5 to 6 years for 8 different charges, including armed assault with intent to murder and attempted assault and battery by means of discharging a firearm. He was sentenced at the same time for another violent offense that he was allowed to serve concurrently with the 5 to 6 year sentence he got for shooting at passerby and shooting at police officers. Brown was also ordered to undergo 5 years of probation. Now, he didn't do the 5 to 6 years in prison. He did about 3.5 years before he was released May 21st last year. Jack Liu told CBS, the judge had, I believe, a 42-year-old man with a demonstrated documented mental health history. So this is not an intervention, he said. The judge sentenced this individual to 5 to 6 years in state prison with probation with a significant mental health treatment component. That's a fair decision. That's a just decision. That's justice. Justice is not just to adopt whatever the prosecutor says or really whatever the police say. And he said the larger issue may have been failures of mental health treatment after Brown completed his sentence. No, again, I completely disagree with the judge. First of all, we know about the failures in the mental health system, right? Every state in the union has a shortage of mental health professionals. Every state in the union has a shortage of inpatient mental health beds. And Tyler Brown was not just somebody who had a demonstrated documented mental health history. He had a demonstrated documented history of violent offenses. The vast majority of people with mental illness are not violent people. They will not ever commit a crime of violence. Tyler Brown, on the other hand, did repeatedly commit crimes of violence. And the judge in 2021 was well aware of that history. The judge also should have been well aware of the problems in Massachusetts' mental health system. So if you've got somebody with a documented history of violence who is mentally ill, isn't it better to see that they are confined behind bars for as long as the law allows, in part so they can get the treatment that they need? Now, again, mental health system is not perfect in the penal system either. But at least you don't have to worry about, is he taking his meds? Is he going to therapy? You can assure, yes, he is, because we're watching him. We're making him. But that didn't happen. He was released from a psychiatric hospital just actually a couple of days before this shooting on Monday. CBS reports that Brown allegedly made suicidal statements to his parole officer, waved a rifle during a FaceTime call while saying he intended to use it. Now, by the way, he's a convicted felon several times over. If he's waving a rifle around while he's talking to his probation officer on FaceTime, why wasn't a warrant issued for his arrest? Why wasn't he taken into custody? Why wasn't he, again, put back in jail for violating the terms of his probation? Jack Liu, the former judge, says after the defendant served a sentence, there are likely mental health failures by the system, maybe for a lack of funding, but those aren't the responsibility of the sentencing judge. Again, BS. If the judge is aware of the problems within the mental health system, then yes, the judge needs to take that into consideration. Because again, you're dealing with somebody who may be mentally ill, but also has a history of violence. So, you know, I give all the credit in the world to Toby Leary from Cape Gunworks. We were talking with Toby yesterday, and he said there are going to be people trying to defend this. What happened here? And sure enough, there are. So were there failures of the mental health system? Sure. Were there failures of the criminal justice system? Absolutely. And should Tyler Brown have walked out of prison after serving 3.5 years of a 5 to 6 year sentence? No. Because that sentence shouldn't have been 5 to 6 years to begin with, no matter what Jack Liu says. All right. Sorry. I'm incensed about this. On to today's armed citizen story. And this is an unusual one. I realize, by the way, today's show is a little bit longer than normal, but we've got some interesting stuff to talk about here. This is from Florida. Florida Times Union Report. A case cleared in road rage shooting of Joe Starkey by DoorDash Driver. You're a fan of 90s music. You may remember Joe Starkey's name. He was part of the band A Puddle of Mud. And he was shot and killed last December in a road rage incident. And now the prosecutor's office has determined that the DoorDash driver who shot Starkey was acting in self-defense, or at least that there is not enough evidence to charge him with a crime. The 22-year-old DoorDash driver was with his girlfriend in the car. They were actually delivering meals. It was about 9 p.m., December 10th. Starkey and his wife were headed home after eating out at a restaurant. Starkey's wife says they noticed a Jeep that was swerving and darting into their path repeatedly. Mrs. Starkey said she thought the driver might be drunk or texting and driving, and they tried to stay away. But she said at one point the driver aggressively passed their car and then hit his brakes. So she says that her husband pulled over, hoping the Jeep would just drive by. It did not. So she said her husband got out of his car and went to go speak with the driver of that Jeep. She says at no time did he use, threaten, intend, or have any ability to use imminent use of lawful force. At least that was the statement from her attorney. According to the state's attorney, however, it was a little bit different. She said that, again, you know, car was driving erratically. This Jeep was driving erratically. At one point, swerving into their lane, her husband had to repeatedly brake and swerve to avoid making contact. So they both end up at a light. And at that point, the Jeep is behind them. Not in front of them, but behind them. And Joe Starkey, according to his wife, said, "I'm going to go say something." She said she told him not to get out of the car because, quote, people are crazy. But he said, "I'm going to go say something." She apparently reiterated multiple times, "Don't do it." But he did. Walks towards the Jeep. His wife says that she heard a pop and began to panic. She gets out of the car. She sees her husband lying on the street next to the Jeep and a man in camouflage pants holding a gun while talking on the phone. The driver's girlfriend said that she actually didn't recall seeing a whole lot. She was on her phone throughout the drive, basically giving him directions on how to go. As for the swerving in and out of the lane, she said at one point they were in a middle lane. They needed to get into the far right-hand lane to make a turn. But she said her boyfriend used his blinker, moved over into the right lane. She said whoever was in the vehicle behind him, quote, didn't like that, began tailing them with their brights on. She said that agitated her boyfriend, so he stuck his middle finger out the window. Then they made the right turn. She said at the next light, you need to turn left. So then he had to get back over from the, you know, right-hand lane all the way to the left-hand lane. I guess it's a multi-lane road. And she said the other driver began tailgating them again, flashing brights at him. So eventually, again, they end up at this light. The other car is in front of them as they're stopped at this traffic light. Driver's door opens. Guy gets out, walks towards the vehicle. She told investigators the man seemed irate, had his arms flailing around. And when he got to basically the hood of the Jeep, her boyfriend, window was down because apparently he couldn't get into the car otherwise. He's outside a door handle. He drew his gun and said, "Hey, I have a gun. Don't come any closer." But the guy kept walking towards them, approached the driver's window, reached into the window, and that's when her boyfriend shot Joe Starkey. The driver himself, the 22-year-old, again, talked about having to make these, you know, turns and having to go through multiple lanes. The other driver behind him flashing his brights at some point. He said at one point he allowed the man to Joe Starkey to pass before moving over, which now put the vehicle in front of him. They stop at the light. He says the driver immediately gets out, begins to walk towards him. He said that he generally carries a firearm, and because of the man's aggressiveness, he grabbed it in a, quote, defensive position. But he did warn the guy, again, I'm armed, you need to get back. The man continued to approach, reached through the driver's window. The driver said at that point, the man was a threat to himself and his girlfriend. He believed he may have had a knife, so he pulled the trigger. Then immediately called police. Said that he was acting in self-defense to protect himself, his girlfriend, his sister at home, never wished to take a life. And again, based on all of the eyewitness testimony, the state's attorney's office, and not just the eyewitness testimony. Apparently, in August of 2025, the DoorDash driver was also involved in an altercation with a person at a gas station and used his firearm, quote, as a deterrence in self-defense. Don't know what all that entailed, but this is not the first time that he apparently lawfully used his firearm to protect himself. Starkey, meanwhile, according to the Times Union, his history revealed, quote, multiple police contacts and arrests with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, repeated history of arrests for DUI, driving on a suspended or revoked license, an extensive history of traffic violations. Starkey, at the time, apparently was under the influence. I think his blood alcohol level was tested at 0.11, anything over 0.08. is driving under the influence in Florida. So the state attorney's office concluded the totality of the evidence establishes that the driver's use of deadly force was justified under Florida law. He faced a rapidly escalating confrontation, an aggressive approach, and a physical intrusion into his occupied vehicle. His perception of imminent harm was objectively reasonable, supported by both physical and testimonial evidence, and reinforced by statutory presumptions. His actions were also justified by the need to prevent the imminent commission of a forcible felony. Accordingly, the use of deadly force was lawful, and no criminal charges are warranted. The attorney for the Starkey family disagrees and says that they'll be filing a wrongful death suit. It is a sad and tragic situation all around. But again, based on the investigation by the state's attorney's office, it sounds to me like one thing's pretty clear. If Joe Starkey had stayed in his car, he would not have been shot. By getting out of his vehicle, by going to confront the driver in the vehicle behind him, while arguably irate and angry, that was a mistake. And again, according to the state's attorney's office, it was reasonable for the driver to believe that he was in danger, that his girlfriend was in danger, when Starkey reached through the window of that vehicle. That was another mistake. You know, and I've said this time and again, when we see these defensive gun uses involving, that are the result of a road rage incident, I don't care how much somebody annoys you when you're behind the wheel of your car, because 15 seconds after they speed away or you make a turn and they're no longer your issue, you're going to forget about it. You're going to forget about it. To me, there is no circumstance where somebody who's, driving too close to you, acting like an idiot, they're tailgating you, maybe they're brake checking you. There's no circumstance where that needs to escalate to a physical confrontation. And again, that's if you're the victim, right? Obviously, if you are the jerk that's driving aggressively, that's another issue altogether. But if you are being subjected to this kind of aggressive driving, best thing to do, again, drop back, let them go on their way. Turn up your radio, find a favorite song to listen to, sing along, and again, 30 seconds later, that idiot's out of your mind. If Joe Starkey had done that, I mean, assuming that he wasn't, pulled over for DUI, would have made it home safe that night. But decisions were made, and they were bad ones. All right, on to today's good deed of the day. Some good decisions being made. In the state of Washington, Spokane Valley kids receive award after saving man from drowning in a hotel pool. Never seen anything like it, said one of the local fire officials who was there to honor these kids. Tammy Hall, Weston Collins, Ethan Overby, Ray Overby, and Ben Wigeli. All administering CPR and saving the life of a man who was swimming. Actually, I guess the four kids, Ben Wigeli, Weston Collins, Ray Overby, and Ethan Overby. Again, they were staying at the Mirabeau Park Hotel. There was a guy in the pool with them. He was snorkeling. And then all of a sudden, he's face down in the pool and he's not moving. Brian Trevi is the Deputy Chief of Operations for Spokane Valley Fire, said, I've never seen anything like it. There was a person dead in that pool. And these individuals got that person out of the pool, started the chain of life recovery before he even got there. So Kevin Dunn, who's a paramedic captain, submitted the names of these four kids, as well as two adults, Tammy Hall and Donovan Bond, for a life-saving award, saying that the individuals demonstrated exceptional awareness, initiative, and teamwork under pressure, and it's highly unlikely the patient would have survived without their immediate and decisive actions, and they're absolutely deserving of recognition. Ray Overby, who's a high school student, had just taken a CPR class through the fire department a week before, and she was the one who actually started chest compressions. Ben Riddle was part of the team that responded after a 911 call was made. He was aware that CPR had already started, but he was surprised at the progress that had been made before he got there. He said, by the time I got there, the patient was sitting up and was talking to paramedics. He said, we quickly found out the story that these fine young men and women and staff personnel had all helped save this gentleman's life. There was a Tammy Hall, one of the adults, a paraeducator in the West Valley School District, continued chest compressions until paramedics arrived. She was actually getting ready for a banquet at the hotel when she heard screams. She said, I took off running. She said, I took over CPR and a little bit of water came out of his mouth. So I tipped him over, got the water out, brought him back. She said, I could tell he was still there. So I just kept going. Later that day, she said she saw the man again. She said he started crying. I started crying. His wife was crying. Again, a really incredible story. And to make things, I think, even more poignant. So this incident happened in April. Tammy Hall lost her husband in January, and she had performed CPR on him when she found his body, but he was already deceased. And Hall said that she thinks this may have been God's way of telling her to forgive herself for not being able to save her husband. I don't know if that's the case. I do know the Lord works in mysterious ways. And I hope that Tammy Hall has forgiven herself and is not wrestling with that anymore. But again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Tammy Hall and the four kids there, Weston Collins, Ethan Overby, Ray Overby, Ben Wigeli, the other adult there, Donovan Bond, all in the right place, all at the right time, all willing and able to do the right thing to save a stranger in need, and we thank them for their very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this very lengthy version of Bearing Arms Cam & Company. Didn't anticipate it being quite as long as it was today, but I'm glad you stuck around until the end. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And looking forward to seeing you back here again on Thursday as we wrap up our podcast week anyway. All right. Enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here soon. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.